The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jen Fram, and you're listening to Agile or Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Clef, and I'm excited to be joined on this episode by guests Lois Kelly and Dr. Jen Fram. Lois, we had the pleasure of speaking not too long ago about the curse of organizational silence, and I think it was off the air. We spoke about the need for resilience as a key trait in dealing with that, which brings us back to this episode's one of the topics there. So welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
For those of you listeners who are just tuning in and haven't yet listened to The Curse of Organizational Silence, Lois, can you give us a quick summary, your 30-second elevator pitch?
Sure. I've been studying change makers and rebels at work for the past 8 years and have looked at what makes some people really successful and others not so much. And I've found out that the really successful people manage their brain versus letting their brain manage them. And they practice self-compassion.
Nice. And Dr. Jen, we met on the Agile Uprising Coalition. You had a delightful comment regarding one of our 12 Days of Agile podcast. Your direct quote was, "It's a sign of a good episode when you're talking back to the panel while driving." And you're also quite resilient because you've joined us from the future. Good on you, mate. Thanks so much. What's your elevator pitch?
Oh, goodness. So I've worked with senior leaders. I am a tamer of ambiguity. My job is to challenge them how to do change differently, even when they don't want to do it that way. So I've been working with large organizations going through change for just over 20 years now. And I recently published a book for managers and executives who need to lead workplace change, which is Conversations of Change, a Guide to Implementing Workplace Change.
That's a wonderful book, and I'll make sure we have links in the show notes. Now, I understand you two have met, but only virtually.
That's right.
Is that true?
This is right.
We're part of the Change Agents Worldwide community, which are just amazing people. Some are inside large organizations, some are outside, like Jen and I, working inside. And we've had some, I think, Zoom chats, and I was trying to summon up enough courage to wear a Wonder Woman cape last week to a keynote speech I was delivering. Jen saw the post, and she sent me a post where she took on the Wonder Woman persona. So we share that in common.
Wow. So some other common ground that at least the three of us share. I don't sport a cape. Is as you guys both said, we try to help individuals and organizations navigate that tricky territory of change, which means breaking that hard-trodden soil of the status quo. It's not easy for anybody, especially as they've risen high into organization. Four topics have surfaced in our conversations and preparation for this show. It takes a good deal of courage, resilience, and vulnerability. Surprises me, that third one. And it's tough to plow this ground and plant new seeds alone. And that's where alliances come in. And that was one of the topics that we touched on during our previous chat, Lois. So we'll see how far we can get on those topics in the next hour. So let's just jump right in. When I think about courage, my favorite quote comes from General Patton. Courage is fear holding on just 1 minute longer. Lois, How do you look at courage? What are the traits? What does it mean to you?
I like to break courage down. It just seems, courage seems like such a big, honorable thing. It's like, how do you do that? And so the research shows that there are four traits of courage. One is honesty, which is speaking the truth. The second is perseverance, which is sticking, you know, hanging in there, getting done. The third is enthusiasm and energy. And the last one, which is bravery. Most people think of courage and they only think of bravery. But those other three traits are pretty important. And they're all things that can be learned and practiced. You know, we're not just born with courage. You know, it's not as if we have it or we don't. It can be developed. I think that's really important.
That's good to know. Dr. Jen, your thoughts on courage?
I'm doing a lot of exploration into courage at the moment because in my work and thinking about it, when you work in change, you frequently work in a state of courage or on the boundaries of courage, or at least you should be. You know, I risk weekly getting fired by clients for some of the things I bring to the table and yet curiously don't. And I think when, from a change maker, so those of us who are actually actively agitating for change in organisations, who perhaps naturally have a strong sense of courage and work in courage, the challenge for us is to, sometimes we become immune to how hard that can be to access, or we become dismissive of it. It's somewhat easy for us, but for others it isn't. And the piece that I'm really exploring at the moment is exactly what Lois has talked about, is that for me, I see courage, or I recognize courage easily in these big acts, the bravery. You know, I talk about chin jutting out and chest out, but I'm wondering if I'm actually that skilled in the smaller micro moments of courage, so those other nuances. So that's what I'm really exploring, what that would bring to my change practice this year.
You mentioned working at the edge. How do you know where that is?
I think you know when you're on the edge, when there's a lot of energy, positive energy, and there's a lot of positive fear in the room. You know, so people can see it and they can feel it and they want it. And then they default to worry and fear because it's just, it's too out. It's so on the edge.
How do you know? So I've been diving into the topic we talked about earlier, organizational silence. And one of the white papers I discovered was fascinating because I thought in terms of black and white, silence and voice. I can't drum up the authors, but they talked about a multidimensional aspect to silence and voice. And one of the fascinating things for me was there's at least three different types of silence or voice. And so when you're in this situation where you perceive, where there isn't vocalization of fear, how do you know if people are being silent because they're afraid, or they have nothing to say, or they're just being pro-social? How do you develop that sense of empathy for your clients? You touched on it too, Jen, where you said, you know, we're so used to being on the edge, we kind of forget what it's like to be just on this side of that boundary.
So for me, I think you ask, how do you know? For me, I see it in the rate of breathing changes in the room. So really attuning to what's happening at a physical level. And the posture changes, the tension, the muscular tension in people changes when they start to get excited or have positive fear. But the second piece of that that's really important in my work is the calibration. And so actually saying to that person, it looks like this idea is exciting you. Is that correct? So not prejudging what you're seeing and actually calibrating that with the person, you know, being courageous enough to call out, John, you look really uncomfortable with this concept. What's going on for you? And calling out, giving permission to bring that to the table.
So you've developed antenna to discern positive from negative fear?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's distinct differences in what you will see in terms of the physicality and the breathing and the tone. That, you know, the edge you hear in the voice.
And I think the questions are the secret, because it's how you ask the questions begins to uncover what's really going on. And I think that when it's a situation that it's unknown, you think there might be fear, or you just don't know what's going on, when you turn to questions in a very open way, that's the only way to find out what's really going on.
Yeah, so often that's right. The case. Not open questions, not leading.
And voiced with a spirit of curiosity, so that, you know, you have to be really careful how you ask those questions, that there's not a judgment included with the question.
Now, do you change your approach depending on who you're dealing with in terms of hierarchy? Mm. Or is it, you're just all human beings, we all have the same amygdala, and here we go? Or does it matter? Does status matter in your approach?
I think that different people have different triggers. So it's helpful to know what might be triggering them. So, you know, Dr. David Rock, in his book, Quiet Leadership, in the work that he's done in neuro leadership, says there are 5 triggers. And I try to figure out which of those triggers, positively or negatively, are affecting the person. You know, is it status? Is it sort of a desire for certainty, autonomy, a sense of fairness, or relatedness?
That's the SCARF model.
Right. Yeah, it's really helpful because different fears are connected to different triggers. So for some people, they just want to get into certainty so fast. You know, they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to be embarrassed. And so then once you kind of understand that, you can work with it. Or if it's status, that's a whole other approach.
Resilience, capacity to adapt to stress or loss healthfully, or when, Lois, you had a great statement that I came across about resiliency. And I've sort of lost the source of that. But it's about resilient practices. Can I get you to read that paragraph?
Sure. Resilient practices help you to keep going. Find meaning in the often long and political process of creating change. And see the good in organizations, even on days that can feel like you're lost in a bureaucratic hairball. Without the capacity to stay resilient, rebels often suffer, become bitter, angry, and not the best versions of themselves. And then they serve no one, their organizations, not their family and friends, and not themselves.
I love the image of the bureaucratic hairball. and power of one of you offered it up. Just one more day. That's all you have to make. One more day. And Jen, I want to tie in something you talk about in resilience, this incredibly powerful concept that is just in the word yet. Can you unpack that?
Sure. I think, I think there's such power in the language we use, and the language we use unconsciously or consciously creates opportunity to change. So when you're in a space of we can't do that, we shouldn't do that, we won't do that, I can't do that, you know, I don't know how, what you're doing is you're literally putting a full stop on potential and opportunity. So you're shutting it off at the pass. If you're engaged with someone else, you're actually triggering a threat response for them because you're saying no to them. Now, the power of using a word like yet is that it becomes the semicolon to your sentence. There's more to come. So I can't do that yet means that there is potential for more to happen. I can't, you know, we shouldn't do that at the moment creates a reason for what could happen in the future. And so I think for me, what you do is when you use the word yet or you punctuate your sentences with language that permits opportunities, you actually create an invitation for others to come with you in change.
And it keeps you going.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, we can't do that here yet.
Yeah.
Such a great aspect of opening up the possibilities.
Yes.
with such a simple word.
And there's such beautiful optimism in it because it implies that there is more to come. Mm-hmm.
And it works almost at any level, right? I couldn't possibly present to senior leadership my new idea because, you know, I'm not good at giving presentations yet, right? I don't understand what's motivating my boss yet. Nobody's interested in my opinions here yet.
Spoken like a true rebel.
But when you keep running and tripping over that hairball, you need that resilience to say, okay, today I can't do it, but maybe tomorrow I can. So I guess there's a practice in there for all of us. So Lois, you mentioned earlier that we're born with certain traits, eat, sleep, and poop. The rest of the stuff we learn. So do you have some practices that help us build resiliency?
Yeah, I mean, I think with resiliency, you know, part of it, which I think is really fascinating that people talk about a lot, but, part of it is, you know, you just said eat, sleep. I mean, what you eat, how you sleep, the research on just being physically taking care of yourself. If you have a good night's sleep, everything the next day looks okay. I just finished a class and it was a week, and the people in the class, they were Broadway actors, and there was someone who's sort of a very well-known singer, performer. And they were talking about when they're on the road that to stay resilient, they run, there's no alcohol, they sleep. And they were just talking about how the physicality is so important. So, I mean, we all know that, but sometimes we forget. The other thing with resilience is it's sort of like understanding that we can control our brain and we can control how we show up for things. So when we're lost in that bureaucratic hairball, or, we're just exhausted, or someone says something that's mean-spirited and kind of puts a damper on those things, we can either decide to be angry and beaten, or we can decide to show up, with a sense of curiosity. But that's in our power. And I think that with resiliency, it's like stuff is going to come at us, and it's how we respond to it that makes us resilient. And if our brains are not cooperating, we have to tell our brains to, like, we need different behavior. Like, just stop that. I love that I was reading a book, and the psychologist said that she treats her brain like a disobedient child, when it's playing, doing all that negative self-talk. And she's like, I'm sorry, we just can have no more of that kind of talk around here. It opens you, it switches, and it kind of gives you that buoyancy.
It's also opening up a channel into the concept of vulnerability for me. Something you said about addressing mean-spirited comments or emails or communications at work, one part of your brain might fight back, but in this sense of being a good rebel or a resilient rebel, you may choose to show up with vulnerability to say, ow, that really hurt. I felt attacked. Did you intend to do that? I want to dive into vulnerability because when we were preparing for this show, one of you, I think it was you, Dr. Jen, mentioned vulnerability as a key element. And that was a surprise to me, that part of navigating change and being brave and courageous had this element of vulnerability to it. Why vulnerability?
Yeah. Look, and it's a tough one to explore. And I think part of where this started to come, when it became really concrete for me, was the recognition that it's really easy to be vulnerable when everything's going to poo, right? When you're at the bottom of your valley and you've got no hope, whether it's career or, what's going on with the family life, all that kind of stuff, it's really easy to ask for help. And then things will change. So you achieve change through that. The challenge that I find for a lot of us professionally is to tap into vulnerability when things are good. So to really access that part of yourself which says, look, I actually don't know the way forward and I need help from your professional peers. But the thing is, if you're doing that while things are in a state of goodness and good health, professionally or career-wise or organizationally, it can only get so much better. So you're accessing change from a really good place rather than the bottom of the valley. But to do that, to be vulnerable means that you've got to move into a space which is probably going to feel a little bit uncomfortable. And I think that the piece for me is really that alignment with vulnerability and resilience. So people who are comfortable with being vulnerable professionally in organizations also happen to be a lot more resilient because they've got access to people who can help them, better thoughts, better ideas, you know, that positive perseverance kind of thing. So it's a place that often we don't want to go because it feels really uncomfortable, but it's so, so powerful. And of course, you know, Brené Brown and the Power of Vulnerability, you know, she talks about vulnerability being the birthplace of creativity, change, and innovation. It's that idea that she's dead on. It absolutely is the birthplace, but you don't have to wait till it gets really crap to access it.
That's beautiful, because my inclination was to tie it to the bottom of the hole. Yeah. And that dark space where it's all gone to shit.
Mm-hmm.
You had also done some writing and some investigations about the relationship between resilience, vulnerability, and change from an agile transformation point of view.
Mm. Yeah.
And since a lot of our listeners are from that space, I wonder if we can explore that for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we're dealing with dysfunctional agile practices. Yeah. We're dealing with sometimes a rigid old world mindset. How can we weave all this together and bring it to agility?
Big task, big task. And I welcome, Lois, your thoughts on it as well. I think to start with, there is a delicious irony that a lot of the agilists that I meet are very rigid in mindset. So there is one way to do what they do. And should you propose an adaptation or doing things a little bit differently, there's extreme discomfort. And I find that incredibly fascinating, but perhaps not surprising, because if you look at the organizational change community, we're all control freaks. So, you know, our dysfunctions permit our strengths, professional strengths. It's okay. And I think what I'm also seeing is a tendency to use resilience as a scapegoat for bad agile practice or bad practice in agile conditions. So if the team, the dev team was just a little bit more resilient, they'd cope with all these interruptions and anti-patterns. So the blaming around this lack of the resilience quality when they're actually putting their hands up and going, hey, guys, we're not doing this well. There should be a little bit more predictability over what we're doing and consideration of the anti-patterns that are in play. And so I find that a little bit challenging. I think that's something we really need to explore is at what point do you use resilience, and maybe the same thing as vulnerability. At what point do you move into a space of drawing on your resilience, and what space do you say enough's enough? This isn't good practice. So, yeah, that's kind of – but to do that, you've got to be vulnerable. You've got to risk. You've got to take risks, and you've got to be courageous. You know, they all start to come together to be able to call out dysfunctions in an organization.
And tied in with that, you know, part of being resilient is you're learning from everything, right? And so you're saying, what might I be getting wrong? Or who else might I need to bring this? Or, you know, you're asking those questions, which are very vulnerable because you're saying, I don't have all the answers. Maybe the team, we've been on this course and we're stuck. And it's turning to that inquiry and asking those questions and knowing that you don't have to have all the answers.
Not easy to do. And largely, there are no answers because most of the places we're dancing in are complex or chaotic. And so it's a best guess. And you have to go in with, there's a lot of stuff I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that does bring it together. Lois, you had talked about finding our strengths. And we also said that, you know, none of these are, you know, we're born with or not. But how do we find out all these character strengths that make up us as humans? How do we find out where we are now and what we're strong in, what we're weak in, what we can learn to develop?
I really like, I'm sort of a skeptic on a lot of ways to find your strengths. I think I've taken every self-assessment as part of my corporate life. And I don't know, people are like, what's your Myers-Briggs? And I'm like, I don't know, E, what's like, what are all those initials? And so I'm very much a skeptic. And when I was introduced to the VIA character strengths research, I was skeptical. And it sort of won me over. It was a huge one of the largest psychological studies in the last 30 years that looked at, instead of looking at all the things that are wrong with people, it looked at and tried to categorize what are the universal strengths that every human being has. And they came up with 24 strengths that we all have. And then there's a weighting. You know, we all have some that are much more dominant than others. And when we like about these strengths, they're innate strengths. It's not how we do things, but they're who we are. So when you understand what your strengths are, it's like the old Peter Drucker, you know, his article, you know, in his research, go from a B to an A versus trying to go from a C to a B. When you understand what your strengths are, it's like, how do I really bring those and use them? And when you're really using those strengths, it gives you energy. Really. And, you know, in this whole resilience and courage, you know, it's about, you know, managing our energy, and the strengths give us that. What I also like about the strengths in working with our teammates is when we understand what the strengths of other people, it can help us work together better. It can also help get through conflict better. I was in a team and I was out of my mind frustrated. One of the people pointed out, he said, Lois, well, one of your traits is, you know, you're brave and creative. And what we need now at this point in the project is we need teamwork and fairness. And those are my strengths. He said, so why don't you just get off the calls every week? Because you're just getting irritated and we don't need your strengths anymore. And it was, I was like so grateful to him for seeing that. And it gave us a language versus just being irritated with one another.
I'm smiling broad and wide. And since this is radio, you can't see that. How did you get to that point? How did you know each other's strengths? Had you both taken the VIA survey and shared results, or just chatted? So you had done this in the same way that we do the Myers-Briggs or the DISC? And
yeah, when I go in to work with teams in very large organizations on complex projects or things we're trying to work through, big change initiatives, I ask that we all take it together. So it's a way to get to know one another that's based on some research and that's really valuable. You know, it's so much better than like dippy, you know, those dippy team bonding sessions where you, you know, go down roller coasters together. So then we have that common language and it helps us, you know, we share that. So it's free. You can go to the VIA Institute. So everyone can take it for free.
I'll dig out the link and put it in the show notes. I'm curious, so these strengths, have you found them to be fairly persistent over time in your own life? They aren't situational?
They're fairly consistent. I took my first VIA 15 years ago. The order of my strengths have shifted, but the top 8 really dominant strengths have remained consistent.
Yeah, mine haven't. So mine have shifted around a fair bit over a couple of years. And I put that down to a lot of the work I do is, you know, you're the protean team member. Your role is to come in and look at where there are gaps and fill them to make change happen. And as such, at any point in time, you're consciously drawing upon strengths that you mightn't have in the past. And so if you're doing a survey at that point in time and you answer those questions, they'll be heavier weighted. I think you asked the question before, Andy, about, you know, do you do this at the beginning of a team project? I did this 2 years ago with a team and in our project kickoff. So we did a strengths deployment inventory, which is similar to the VIA. It gives you the language of the concept of an overplayed strength. So sometimes when you see really bad behavior, so the example, you know, Lois, I won't say you were really badly behaved, but, you know, that can be disruptive. It's a case of an overplayed strength, which is a beautiful way of looking at something that's challenging you in conflict. And the link for me and how powerful strengths were and in understanding, being really overt about people's strengths, is that makes it a hell of a lot easier to be vulnerable because you know who to go to ask for help. It's a lot more difficult if you actually, you know, if you have fear and anxiety that in asking for help, there won't be someone who can come forward. But if you're clear on everybody's strengths, you go, actually, the person who's really good at persistence and detail is probably who I need to access vulnerability with.
And what a great way to get a full view of the team you're part of, particularly when you're forming and getting to know each other. I love that. So I'll find links to this character survey. We'll include them and we'll go from there. Wow, what's next? Alliances, building this resilience at not only a personal level, but an interpersonal level. We talked a little bit, Lois, in the Organizational Silence podcast about alliances, but I think it's key enough an ingredient to this mix of navigating change and showing up. So I'd love to go over it again. You had talked about a couple of different types. If you can unpack them for us against your support pack, your wild pack.
Right. And then your caring pack, which tends to be our friends or our family members.
Tell us more about all of those.
Yeah. I mean, to me, there are our caring pack are the people that's pretty, you know, those are our friends or our spouses who just kind of tend to our souls. At work, I see the support pack of the people who they're very process focused. It's like, how do we get through this? What needs to be done? And they are sometimes the most resilient people because they're playing the long game. And then I think we all need a wild pack. And the wild pack are probably our bravest, courageous, most creative thinkers who pretty naturally don't worry about what anyone's going to say, right? Who they're sort of the daring thinkers. And you need those wild ideas. And then the support people are there to say, okay, fantastic ideas. How do we now work them through the system? And, you know, some people have both skills, but you need all those groups around you.
And when you do the character strength survey, I'm guessing it gives you some idea of who might be in what camp.
It does.
You know, when you need judgment, mm-hmm. right, from the support group, should I go this way or not? It's helpful.
And I also have found in the work that I've done and the teams I've been on, a lot of people who are amazing in the support pack, they have prudence, they have spirituality, and they have relationships, love, which is relationships. When you do this survey and it comes back love, people are like, I don't want to be known for love, but God forbid, it's a work situation. But love is about relationships. And, you know, and I think it is, I worked with a team recently and it was a high functioning team. They were a delight. They were moving mountains. And so many of them had love, spirituality, and teamwork in their strengths.
We talked not too long ago with Lisa Adkins in a podcast about agile and mindfulness. And the topic of love came up as well. And she teased it apart as love is separate from sex and power. And so many people conflate the three. And when you can approach relationships with just pure love without the overlay of sex or power, it can be amazing what you can accomplish.
And I think that's what people are yearning for in work. You know, they they're looking for meaning and what's the company's purpose and what are our values. And while that's important, I also think people are looking for that love and compassion and support from their coworkers. You know, and sometimes you're never going to be, especially, well, Andy, you know, in really large organizations, you're never going to get a purpose that says, oh, great. But with our coworkers, you know, our mates, we can create meaning in how we work together.
Yeah, I love the word pack because it reminds us of our basic nature, right? The worst punishment besides death that we inflict on each other is solitary confinement, right? That's the harshest thing we come up with. So yeah, we are pack creatures. And without showing up with love for your fellow pack mates, they aren't really your fellows. Jen, what are your alliances like? How do you build them? How do you find them? How do you nurture them?
That is such a good question. I think to some extent, a lot of the alliances I have come through recognizing and validating people. So really seeking to understand who people are, and that's okay and that's valid. And so when you move into relationships in that space, automatically people start to sift into different packs, to use that language. And to some extent, those alliances, they form organically for me in organizations and outside. But, you know, it really gets back to the neuroscience kind of stuff, the tribal, you know, are you like us? Are you going to eat us? And those people who are, you know, using Lois's language, the wild pack, there is that sense of recognition within minutes. And interestingly, it's usually preceded by an experience of, I don't like that person. That person has pissed me off. And then it takes some time to recognize, well, actually, that's because they're just like me.
they have a super a Wonder Woman cape.
Correct. And then you've got to do that dance to work out how does the wild pack work together, you know, and it can be quite a fancy foot affair. So, you know, I think it's really about people just have this universal need to be validated, you know, whether that's expressed through love or, you know, you are enough, that makes a huge difference in sorting out alliances.
Yeah, and just the whole notion of appreciation, you know, that is the number one greatest motivator at work is feeling appreciated for specific competencies or contributions. And so I think when we are seen, it motivates us. And when we can reciprocate by seeing in others and expressing that, that builds their resiliency and that builds their courage. And when you have a culture of appreciation, it also allows you to be vulnerable.
Now, there's a whole nother show in appreciation. Right? That human need to be recognized. And it doesn't take a lot. I coach my team. It takes 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And do it in public where other people can get that same neurotransmitter hit of appreciation. It's such a powerful, powerful thing in teamwork, particularly when somebody might be feeling down because of that proverbial hairball. Yeah.
And I think if you can make it a habit and just build it in, I like a Friday afternoon habit where teams on their networks just share what went well this week. And everyone just posts the three good things. So often we, you know, in large projects that take a long time, we feel like we're not making any progress or we've been beaten down with too many meetings. And those three good things on a Friday afternoon kind of raise our energy and build resilience.
That's a beautiful note to end on. We're coming up on time, so we'd like to reserve a little bit of spot so that our guests can share some upcoming events, shout out a few things that they've been working on. Jen, what's coming up in end of February, March for you?
Well, probably just tipping over into the next month, I've got a keynote at Convergence Australia, which will be in Melbourne in April, and I'll be talking about why leaders don't step to the front of the stage and what are the motivations that's going on behind that. So really looking forward to that. Yeah.
Nice. And what are the best ways for our listeners to get in touch with you, Jen?
Twitter, I'm probably the most responsive on, at Jen Fram on Twitter. More than welcome to connect with me on LinkedIn. And, of course, there's a Facebook page, Conversations of Change, that they're welcome to join the community there.
Great. And Lois, what's coming up for you?
I'm going to be doing an all-day workshop on creating change and then a keynote speech at the Lean Conference in Iceland in the end of March.
We'll have links to all of those events and ways to get in touch with each of our wonderful guests tonight. Thanks again to both of you. It's been a wonderful pleasure. Thanks to you, to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a review, leave a rating or a comment on iTunes, Stitcher, your platform, podcast receiver of choice. It really helps others find us. And if this is your first time tuning in, subscribe. And if you'd like to be courageous, join the discussion and share all your vulnerabilities publicly to the world at coalition.agileuprising.com. Until next time, this is the Agile Output. Until next time, thank God for post-production. I am fried. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising podcast, signing out.